fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I don't think Islam's going to survive the 21st century. I really don't. They have a high birth rate, but a lot of people are leaving it.
The Imam of Peace, he was speaking to Brandon Tatum. He said it's a myth that Muhammad was, you know, married like a 9-year-old.
Yeah, I saw it. There are some that will say that, and I think it also comes from a place of normalcy. They don't want that to be true. Why would you want that to be true? So does 65, and it specifically says the waiting period of a girl who has not yet, a young girl who has not yet hit her puberty, is 3 months. And I showed them, and sometimes I see it in their eyes, especially the younger Muslims. They go, I don't agree with that at all. And
you're delving into Islamic texts. Do you think that we're doing a disservice when we constantly try to make this distinction between, well, there's radical Islam and then there's Islam, because some would argue, but then that's actually just avoiding some of these problematic texts?
You want me to be honest? Like, you want me to just tell you?
Well, yeah. I want to show a clip of you talking to, I think this guy is a Muslim, where you seem to be a lot more knowledgeable than he was. Let's have a watch.
You've read the Quran?
Yeah, I have it right here.
Okay, that's respect.
You believe that people say, like, the Quran spreads,
like hate and,
yes.
And, like,
it does?
Yeah.
Can you show me a verse?
Sure. Surah 4, Ayat 34.
Can you read me the verse in English?
Thus virtuous women are obedient and preserve their trust such as God wishes them to be preserved. And those you fear, women, may rebel, admonish, and abandon them in their beds, so smack them. If they obey you from there, seek no other way against them, because God is highest and mightiest.
Now let me read that verse to you in Arabic. Do you read the verses before and after? Because, you know, there's,
yeah,
context.
I've read the whole Quran twice.
Does not say that, brother.
What's it say?
It says teach them. Okay. Look up the specific word and translate it.
The reason I know you're wrong is because the tafsir specifically says when you hit them to make sure you do not leave a mark on their face. So let me just ask you a question. Why would the tafsir say not to leave a mark if you're just supposed to be teaching? How could teaching possibly leave a mark?
As in, like, don't insult them.
That's not what it says. It says do not leave a mark on their face, and it says to not use anything bigger than a toothbrush or a toothpick.
Okay, so smacking someone with a toothpick is violent?
Well, my question for you, I don't believe it's extremely violent. I still think it's wrong to do that to a woman. But my question to you is, can the woman do it to the man if he is disobedient to her?
I'm not no scholar, but you know.
No, he can't. No, she cannot. She can't do that.
I feel like no.
Okay.
I think not, yeah.
Surah 9, Ayats 29 through 30. The Jews say Ezra is the son of God, which, by the way, that's not even true, while the Christians say Christ is the son of God. This is what they say from their very mouths, thereby agreeing with the speeches of the unbelievers who came before them. May Allah strike them down in how they pervert the truth.
Strike down, you know, like, hey, it can mean many things.
Surah 5, Ayats 50 through 51. Do not take Christians and Jews as allies, for if you do, you are one of them.
No, because the Quran tells us Ahlul Kitab, which means the three Abrahamic religions, were actually allowed to marry and have kids with them.
Actually, only the men can do that. The women are not allowed to do that, and you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, also very wrong. Your prophet Muhammad, during one of the hadiths in Sahih al-Bukhari, specifically said women have a deficient mind, and that hellfire is filled with women because they are disobedient to their husbands. And so when you go to hell, it's full of women. Man can marry a Christian or a Jewish woman, yet they're doing that because they're trying to put their religion onto the child, because the child, by Islamic law, would be Muslim if the father is Muslim. That's why they don't allow Muslim women to marry out. I also have 2:6 as well. As for the unbelievers, which is talking about people like me, it is all the same if you warn or do not warn them. They will not believe because God has sealed up their hearts, their hearing, and their vision with the shroud, and a terrible punishment awaits them. What this verse is saying is that I will never believe the Quran because Allah put the shroud over me. Allah sealed up my heart. Allah sealed up my hearing. But then he's going to punish me for it. Why is he punishing me if he's the one that's sealing up my hearing, my vision, and my heart? Next, we can move on to where I can show you in the Quran where it allows you to marry prepubescent women.
Where what, sorry?
So next, if you don't have an answer for that, we can talk about where it allows you to marry prepubescent women. Women before, girls, before they hit their puberty. He ran away.
One of the themes that I've found throughout a lot of your conversation with some of these Muslims is there's actually quite a lot of ignorance there within the Muslim community, it seems, among some, at least some of the people you're speaking to, with regard to their own texts.
Yes, the Muslims, they're very tribal people, and in some ways there's a lot of advantage to that. They're very protective, you know, that can be a good thing, obviously depending on how you do it. But that tribalism also comes with a sense of, from what I've noticed, a sense of shame. And what I mean by that is that Muslims who don't really know a lot about their religion, so I think it's 70% of Muslims don't even speak Arabic, and they really encourage that for the Quran. And it's funny because when I've met some, they're like, no, I can read it in Arabic. And I'm like, but do you know what it means? So like, no. So I'm like, so you just memorize the sounds. And so I think there's more of a sense of like, I want to kind of know these talking points and say this more than it is to actually like learn your religion in Islam. And the other concept is I kind of like want to bring up on top of, I guess, a sense of pride is... No, I guess it's still kind of pride. It's just like this sense that they really, really want to defend it. And sometimes I see it in their eyes when I bring up some of these hadiths, Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih Muslim. These are the authentic ones. I mean, these are the ones that are accepted. And the things in the Quran, 65:4, I believe it is, it talks effectively about you're allowed to marry prepubescent girls and have intercourse with them. Because they'll say, oh, and you're not allowed to really do it until they hit puberty, as if that's better. And then I show them in Surah 33, it specifically says, if you do not consummate, you know, have intercourse, then there's no waiting period. And then you go over to Surah 65, and it specifically says the waiting period of a young girl who has not yet hit her puberty is 3 months. So it's like I tell them and I show them, and sometimes I see it in their eyes, especially the younger Muslims, they go, like, you know, they're coming from a place like, I want to defend it, but they also look like, I don't agree with that at all. And sometimes I actually kind of feel bad.
Do you know the Imam of Peace? Have you seen, he was speaking to Brandon Tatum, explaining that he said it's a myth that Muhammad was, you know, married like a 9-year-old or whatever.
Yeah, I saw it. There are some that will say that, and I think it also comes from a place of normalcy. They don't want that to be true. Why would you want that to be true? Because Muhammad is not just a man. He's the most perfect man to ever exist and ever will exist. And it's interesting, a lot of Muslims, when I tell them about, you know, Aisha, what they'll say to me is, oh, well, did you know that Delaware, some years ago, they didn't have minimum age of marriage and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, that's if somebody did that also. If there's a 54-year-old Delaware man who marries a 6-year-old, 9-year-old, that's also wrong. But the difference is that's not a prophet. That's not 2 billion people saying that's the most perfect man to ever exist and ever will. And so another thing they'll say a lot is, well, at the time it's different. You know, he was in the 600s. And I'm like, again, is he the most perfect man today even and tomorrow? Or am I judging him as the average person in the 600s? To answer your question about, there's some that try their hardest, apologists who will take another hadith that talks about Aisha's sister and when she was born, and they subtract the math and they determine that she was anywhere between maybe 14 to some say as high as 18. I've looked into this. It's very, very much a stretch, whereas Sahih al-Bukhari, and it's not just Sahih al-Bukhari, it's all over Sahih al-Bukhari, it's all over Sahih Muslim. It's not just one hadith I'm cherry picking, it's all over. But 5133, Sahih al-Bukhari 5133, is narrated by Aisha herself, saying, the Prophet married me at 6 years old, consummated the marriage at 9. You also look at the life of Muhammad when he signed the marriage contract when he was in Mecca. And he signed the marriage contract, she was 6. And then you do the math also when they go to Yathrib. Yathrib is Medina today, but at the time it was called Yathrib. And that's when he goes first. Aisha and Abu Bakr stay behind. Abu Bakr is the companion of Muhammad, but the father of Aisha. They stay behind, and then later she joins Muhammad, and that's when she was, you know, 9, and that's when they consummate the marriage. And so when you look at all that, and you also do the math, it lines up perfectly with her being 6 to 9. Some say 7 to 9. But, yeah, to answer your question, finally, yeah, there's some that try their hardest. I don't blame them for it, especially if they seem like nice people. They're coming from a place that it's like, I can't denounce my prophet, but I also don't want that to be true. So they try their hardest to, well, if you do this math and you take this hadith and you kind of put it together, she might have been 14, actually. I get it. I get it. I do. I don't blame them. Do I agree with them? No, not at all. I've read enough.
Yeah. And I'm curious about this one. So people like Imam of Peace, obviously, you know, they say a lot of really important points, shake up, you know, narratives within the Muslim community. He's clearly a good guy. But given your delving into Islamic texts, do you think that we're doing a disservice when we constantly try to make this distinction between, well, there's radical Islam and then there's Islam? Because, you know, some would argue, but then that's actually just avoiding some of these problematic texts, which are there regardless of whatever type of Islam one may identify with.
You want me to be honest? Like, you want me to just tell you?
Well, yeah.
Okay. My personal opinion on it, as someone who has studied it heavily, I've taken Middle Eastern history classes that delve deeply into the Prophet Muhammad from a historical point and also from a religious point. There's Islam. Okay. My opinion is that radical Islamists, right, follow the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad significantly closer. I don't think there's really anything today that ISIS, Daesh, and a lot of these Islamist groups, Hamas, that they don't do anything that the Prophet Muhammad didn't do. Now, of course, you know, with an advancement of technology, sure, they can do some different things, but I'm talking about in terms of the values. The Prophet Muhammad would go to one of the tribes, the Jewish tribes in Yathrib, accuse them of betraying him. Even if that was true, the Islamic sources say it's true, but we don't know if it is or not. But even if it's true, this one Jewish tribe betrayed him in a battle. He doesn't just stop at the people that may or may not have betrayed him. He takes all of the Jewish boys, he lines them up, the ones that are right at the age of puberty, he drops their pants. He looks at, and by the way, this is all confirmed in Islamic tradition, texts, hadiths, sahih hadiths, drops their pants, looks, if they have pubic hair, he chops their head off. He kills them. Or he gets someone to do it for him. And then if they don't have pubic hair, then he pretty much enslaved them. And he kills Safiya bin Huyai. She's a Jewish woman, one of his wives. Kills her father, her husband, and then marries her, right? Which you got to understand, women at the time, you lost your father, you lost your husband, you don't have a way to live. So they'll say, oh, he got her consent. Okay, a couple things. One, not really. You just killed her husband and then you marry her. And then, of course, that means sexual relations, which is to anyone normal, that's called rape. But what's interesting is there's another hadith also, and I think it's Sahih Muslim, maybe Sahih al-Bukhari. I'll send it to you after. There's another hadith where it says, if you were to marry one of these effectively slaves or people that you, you know, take, these women, these glories of war, if you will, Aisha asked the Prophet Muhammad, how do you know you got her consent? What if she's shy and she's silent, doesn't say anything? And the Prophet Muhammad answers and says, her silence is her consent. Of course, that's insane. Nobody would think that, but the Prophet thinks that. And so, where was I going with this? Oh, right. To answer your question, yeah, I think there is a bit of a disservice. I have no problem with Muslims, right? A Muslim, like same, a Jew, like same. A Christian, like an atheist, you could be a good person, a bad person.
Sure.
I judge you individually. I will cozy up more with a Muslim who's a nice, respectful person more than a Jewish person who's an asshole to me. Facts. It's not about Muslims. Imam of Peace, great guy. I love listening to him. I have Muslim friends. I've been on panels, interfaith panels, non-Jewish panels with Muslims. Have no issue with them. Love them. It's not about that. It's about what I have learned in Islam. I've read the Quran twice. I've read over 15 to 20,000 hadiths. Some of them repeat themselves, but nonetheless. And when you read this stuff, now there's a lot of great stuff in the Quran. And honestly, it's the stuff that they really just took from Judaism or Christianity, but still a lot of great stuff in it. It's not like it's every sentence just hateful. Of course not. But if you look at the people in Daesh and Hamas and PIJ, etc., Boko Haram, you're going to tell me the Taliban, you're going to tell me they're not following their book. Of course they're following it. I don't buy this idea where it's just like, oh, they're using it for their own gain. No, I bet you if you go talk to any of them, they can point to something in the Hadith or the Quran of why they're doing what they do. And so what I generally say is the difference between a radical Muslim and a moderate Muslim is the radical Muslim will say, you do what I say or I'll chop your head off. And the moderate Muslim will say, you do what I say or he'll chop your head off. And that's, I truly, I see that a lot. I think there's a lot of apologetics. And if Islam truly wants to survive the 21st century, which this is my prediction, I'll probably be dead, obviously, but somebody save this clip. When it hits 22nd century, see if I'm right. I don't think Islam's going to survive the 21st century. I really don't. They have a high birth rate, and that's how they've been able to grow as they are. But a lot of people are leaving it, and especially in, you know, and maybe not the countries where they're kind of forced into Islam. And the reason I say that is because, to answer your original question, the disservice we're doing is that if you want to survive, if Islam truly, truly wants to survive, I think it's impossible, and I'll tell you why, because you're going to have to, what's the word I'm looking for? You're going to have to modernize, but you can't, because if you read the Quran, it says it in there, paraphrasing a little bit, but it says, there is no mistakes in this book. If you find one mistake, throw the whole thing out. So how can you modernize and change things? It's a very good religion for rigidity. It's a very rigid religion. That's why a lot of people, in my opinion, that come out of the prison system, they go to Islam. And hey, it works actually a lot, because Islam is, you wake up at this time, you do this prayer.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
5 times a day. You do it at these times. You do it before you go to bed. Before you do the prayer, you do wudu. And you do it exactly this way. You wash this and then that and then this. It's very rigid. And for some people, they need that rigidity in their life. And that might work very well. Some people, they need a little bit more questioning and free flow.
Really interesting. First of all, completely agree with, you know, some of the key points you made here. I'm not talking about all Muslims at all. We're talking about Islam as an ideology, as a religion, and these texts. And I'm trying to get to the bottom of what's actually the fundamental problem here. Is it interpretation or not? I also think, you know, there'll be plenty of Muslims who would reject any form of extremism, and they would either try to reconcile it through God knows how they would. Maybe they're just not also aware of certain texts or just not interpret it in those ways. And also, as precisely as you said, Judaism believes that both Christianity and Islam were divine tools to spread Torah ideas to the world, even if some of the messages got lost in translation as well. So that's definitely true. And certainly aspects of Islamic life, putting aside to the Quran, but specific things around wanting to pray, let's say certain things they want to abstain from, fine. There's, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Also, you know,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Judaism would welcome that. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to pray 5 times a day and all that and have certain clear structure. My question, though, is what do you say to those who say, yeah, but come on, Nick, any text can be interpreted in all kinds of ways and you can have the same thing with the Bible? I personally find that, what verses are you talking about in the Bible? Because even if they want to talk about, let's say, well, it says, there's a death penalty for keeping Shabbat. Okay, well, Judaism also has an oral law. And that never happened because, I'm saying once the Jews, you know, build this state in Israel or whatever you'd call it, the Hebrew Republic, whatever you want to call it, the kingdom, because there are such strict laws of prosecuting someone. But the point is more that the Torah is trying to just create a moral standard for how serious Shabbat was, as an example, right? So what's your response to those who say make that claim?
Yeah, so that claim does come up a decent amount. One, a lot of the times you're right. I'll be like, okay, tell me what verse, and they're always misreading it. However, yeah, there are some things that can be very harsh. Just today in my live, somebody told me, like, do you think, wiping out a people is ever okay? And I was just like, well, I mean, this is just a vague question. Where are we going with this? And, he brings up, Amalek, and I'm like, well, first off, if God... God deems anything, let it be done. But that aside, to answer your question, what I generally say is I am more interested, especially looking more from the outside. I'm not Jewish, I'm not Christian, I'm not Muslim, but I've read all of theirs. I've read the Quran, I've read the King James Version, I've read the New International Version, I've read the JPS Tanakh, I've read the Stone Edition Torah. I read the Talmud sometimes because generally, I actually read it because I was debunking a lot of these just misquotes of the Talmud. Oh, it says this, says that. And then I actually just kind of got interested, and it's amazing. I'm nowhere near, anywhere close to even scratching the surface. That thing is complex. But what I'm interested in, I'm interested in the actions of people today. I am interested in what I see on a day-to-day level. So some people like to come up and they say, hey, how come you're not attacking Christianity enough, right? Well, they had the Crusades. I'm like, okay, if you want, I will go in my time machine. I'll go do a TikTok live back during the Crusades and be more than glad to criticize some of the actions of the Crusades. Fine. But I'm not talking about that. Well, in the book of, Isaiah, the book of Genesis, it says this. Again, like you said, a lot of times they're just misquoting it. But let's say hypothetically they're not and there's something I can disagree with. Sure. Okay, fine. But what does that have to do with what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the actions of today and how it's portrayed today. Right, I'm not talking about something that I'm just against because it happened a long time ago. These things are still happening today. And a lot of people in Europe and even here in America, I mean, we just had a, an IED device being thrown in New York City. I'm sure you heard about it. And CNN, they come out with this article. I actually screenshotted it. Let me read you this headline from CNN. Two Pennsylvania teenagers crossed into New York City Saturday morning for what could have been a normal day enjoying the city during abnormally warm weather. Okay, there's a little bit more, but right off the bat, you're just kind of like, okay, why is this a headline? But in less than an hour, their lives would drastically change as the pair would be arrested for throwing homemade bombs. Wait a minute. Why did you add the start of that? What was the reason for that? How about the headline is, domestic terrorist throws bomb in New York City. How about that? Why? What? And it's insane. Oh, and so this is the kind of arguments I hear. That headline is the epitome. It's looking into the mirror of the people that say what you're asking me. Well, yeah, but what about this? What about that? I'm interested in the actions of today. I use Islam in my study of it, and I studied it heavily, and I took notes to understand where that radical movement and radical ideology comes from that we see today throughout the world. You look at the Global Terrorist Index in the top 10. All 10 are Islamic groups.
But the argument is that they'd say, yeah, but okay, but most Muslims are not engaged in terrorism, and so therefore, therefore, your conclusion that it is Islam, when texts can be interpreted differently, is not necessarily fair. That's the argument.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's totally true. There's most Muslims are not putting on suicide bombs and screaming Allahu Akbar and killing people. What I will say is, one, that just means they're just not following Islam as directly. Not that in the Quran it says to put on a suicide vest, but it does say I will cast the terrors into the hearts of my enemies. The Quran does say to strike the necks of every unbeliever.
But couldn't you make the argument, therefore, I'm not saying I agree with this, but couldn't you make the argument, therefore, that just as you're saying I'm interested in what's happening on reality, so therefore the argument that it's going to these texts are necessarily going to lead towards bad stuff when most of them don't do that bad stuff, does the argument still hold? Now, by the way, I would push back and I'd say, well, even if most of them don't, there has been polling, let's say done in the UK, Henry Jackson Society did a poll a couple of years ago, which found widespread majority support for Hamas, for terrorism, sympathy for this kind of stuff, for radicals,
And so even if while they might not do it, even Mehdi Hassan said anti-Semitism is the British Muslim community's dirty little secret. So culturally speaking, there's all kinds of sympathies for this stuff as well, which we don't talk about. But anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're good. You're good. I get what you're saying. And it's well, first off, most Muslims have not read the Quran in depth. Most have not. Most Muslims don't even speak Arabic, which Arabic is a very unique language, and how it's read versus translating to English, it can get a little bit more direct. And even when you find past those, of course, because of our more secular society and our advancements in mankind, of course, there's always going to be the people that are like, I know it says this, but it's not like it's commanding every Muslim shall do it. So, excuse me, most are not going to do it. Disproportionately, though, because of what the Quran says versus maybe what the Bible says or what the Christian Bible says, you're going to see a disproportionate amount, because even in a society where we have advanced beyond a lot of barbarism, because of those words, you're going to see that disproportionate attitude. The reason you don't see most of them is, as you said, there's three types of Muslims. There's the ones that are doing the terrorism directly. And then there's the vast majority in the second group, which is they support it either by being silent and silently supporting it, or just straight out supporting it but not doing it themselves. The third one is the people like Imam Apis. Not as common, very, very much a minority, but they are truly, and I believe him. I believe they are absolutely trying to stamp out this jihadist fight of Dar al-Harb versus Dar al-Islam, which, for those who don't know, Dar al-Harb is the house of war. Dar al-Islam is the house of Islam. They consider, especially Israel, to be the house of war. They consider places where they start to gain not a majority figure, but maybe they gain like 20% of the population. When they're less than that, when they're like only 2%, they're very agreeable people. Very, very agreeable. Very nice, actually. But then when they start to gain a little bit more power and more control, and they start to implement more of these things, all of a sudden you start to see an increase in polling of those that agree with things like Sharia law, whereas before it was maybe closer to 30% that only agreed with it. Then it gets to 50% and 70%, and they start to have a more tribal attitude towards that. But yeah, I mean, like I said, to answer your question, well, why isn't it most Muslims? It never will be most that are doing these direct harms, even if the book was straight up telling them, like, you will do this, like, now. The thing is it doesn't take that. The Nazis had, at some point, I think 28% approval rating. You don't need enough people being right next to you fighting. You just need enough people to close their eyes or support it or just ignore it. That's really what you need for groups like Hamas, PIJ, Boko Haram, Taliban, Daesh. This is what they need to thrive. They don't need everyone to put on a green headband and wave, you know, a Hamas flag. They just need enough people to support them or at least stay silent about them.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with you, by the way. I don't think Islam, unfortunately, is going to be viable. But it is fortunate, because a lot of what people are seeking, the sense of meaning and direction, that will still be there. It just means they're going to have to start tracing back the roots of Islam, towards the roots of Islam, the Torah, and get the, you know, for out of Zion shall come forth the light and the law. That's what I believe is going to happen. Just by the way, one point just for our viewers to be aware of, with, you know, the biggest argument people like Piers Morgan and others will throw back at people that believe in the Torah. So they'll say, but doesn't the Torah say you should kill Amalekites and kill the nation of Amalek? First of all, precisely as you say, where is that happening in practice today? Secondly, Amalek were deemed a nation, or rather a nation with an ideology that was Nazi-like in essence. But there's a few key nuances, because people just assume this means literally the commandment is to kill every single Amalekite individual. First of all, again, we don't know who they would be today, but let's say back then, thousands of years ago. Number one, the Torah itself frames this as a war against a nation, not individuals. Jewish law requires offering peace before war, even going against war against Amalek. If Amalek renounced its ideology, then this commandment would not apply. The Talmud, as I said before, says Amalek is no longer identifiable, and now Jewish tradition often interprets Amalek more symbolically, as like, you know, defeating evil and evil ideologies. And even the biblical narrative showed restraint. So, for example, Saul fights Amalek in the Book of Samuel, but the issue is not random killing of individuals, but rather destroying the leadership of Amalek and the state. And we even know that the Talmud says Haman, who was an Amalekite, his descendants studied Torah in Bnei Brak. They converted, they became Jews. So this idea that it's all about wiping out a bloodline is just not true. So I just felt it's important for our viewers to be aware of that before we finish.
For sure. I didn't know that about Haman's children.
Yeah. Check it out. It says that in the Babylonian Talmud, Gittin 57b, it says that there. The descendants of Haman, who was an Amalekite, studied Torah in Bnei Brak. But Nick, you've been extremely generous with your time today. Thank you so much for all your brilliant work and insights and just bravery. Because you know what? It's one thing to make points online, but it's another thing to actually go up against people and be in the heat of the moment. I know there's a lot of pressure to do that. So just thank you so much for all the work you're doing. It's greatly appreciated. Just hang on for a moment. After covering Israel for years, I've realized that most of the lies boil down to one simple tactic used by Israel's enemies from the very start: the deliberate reversal of cause and effect. And our new documentary exposes exactly how this works. Have a watch of our trailer for our new film called The Great Reversal, and you can watch it in full right now by clicking the link below in the video description. For decades, one idea has shaped how much of the world understands the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel did something wrong, and the Palestinians simply resisted. Whether it's 1948 or the recent war in Gaza, the story is the same every time. Israel provokes, Palestinians resist. Israel oppresses, Palestinians fight back. This narrative dominates campuses, the media, and much of global politics. It feels familiar, it feels intuitive, and for many people, it feels true. But what if the sequence is backwards? What if the origin point and every major chapter that followed has been told in reverse? In the wars of 1948 and 67, in the collapse of Oslo, in the suicide bombings of the Intifada, in the rockets after Israel withdrew from Gaza, in the massacre of October 7th, and the global narrative that followed. In this JTV Plus documentary, we're going to expose the great lie that has reversed cause and effect, a narrative engineered to help the real aggressors erode Israel's legitimacy. We'll trace the conflict from its origins to the present day, revealing how, at every stage, the true sequence of events was inverted, how aggression was reframed as resistance, how defense was recast as provocation, and how a conflict rooted in hatred of Jews was deliberately twisted into a story that blames the Jews. Join us as we restore the story to the order in which it actually happened and uncover the truth hidden beneath a century of lies. To watch this JTV Plus documentary and access much more premium content, click on the link in the video description.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.